is the news podcast from Israel Next, the podcast for an inspired and credible Israel engagement. I'm Roar Sørensen, and this is Inside Out, bringing you Israeli perspectives on the news, and the date is March 4th. So, today we are going to talk about, not surprisingly, what goes on in Ukraine, and also then giving the Israeli perspectives on these things. Israel has taken a measured stand in its criticism of Russia and its invasion of Ukraine. So why? What are the reasons, and are they justified? We'll also talk about the war in Ukraine, which has led to massive and understandable reactions against Russia in the West. But are we pushing it too far? Then, in Israel, political unrest is the name of the game, but the government somehow survives. The glue, anti-Netanyahu glue, seems to stick still. Then in this week's Torah portion, we will talk about stopping up and considering by looking back. But we go to, of course, the main issue, which is Ukraine. So Israel is in a dilemma when it comes to the war on Ukraine. Of course, they are opposed to this war. They see Russia as an aggressor. They see justice is on the side of the Ukrainians. But as the West is condemning Russia, Israel is much more measured in their criticism. So it's true that Foreign Minister Yair Lapid very soon went out and condemned Russia. But the Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, has not really mentioned Russia. I mean, at least he tries to avoid mentioning Russia. He says it's terrible what is happening in Ukraine and all these things. We condemn this. But usually not mentioning Russia. Then we came to this UN vote in the UN General Assembly, where 141 nations voted for condemnation of Russia, and Israel also voted for. So, of course, here they did take a clear stand. The few countries that voted with Russia, I mean, this was an overwhelming majority, 141 nations. There were 35 that abstained and 5 that voted against. And those 5 were nations like Syria and North Korea, Eritrea. I mean, it's not the best company for Russia. But as I said, Israel voted for this condemnation. And their representative also stood up and applauded afterwards. So in some way, Israel is sending a clear signal. And in other ways, they are being more moderate. In addition to this, we also have Prime Minister Naftali Bennett speaking to both Putin and the President of Russia and the President of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky. So he just within a couple of hours the other day, he was speaking to both of them on phone and has been doing this a couple of times, seeming to somehow negotiate or try to bridge the gap. So this is also going on. Israel has, as a few nations in the world, has good connections with both countries. Now, the entire topic of Ukraine is a huge discussion, or it's not a huge discussion in Israel. It's a huge item in Israel, and it's covered all the time in the news. But Israel's moderate position, moderate criticism against Russia, is a huge issue. it's not accepted in by the nation as such. There are huge demonstrations in the streets demanding that Prime Minister Bennett comes down from the fence. The media is constantly, journalists are constantly talking about this and asking themselves, how can we demand other nations to stand up for Israel's right if we don't stand for justice here? So there is a lot of internal criticism against Israel in this case. There was also a picture of some Jewish men standing in draped in an Israeli flag at the Western Wall, praying at the Western Wall, draped in Ukrainian flags. And this picture was shown to the president of Ukraine, Zelensky, and he commented on it. And he said, well, this touches me, but I don't feel that the Israeli prime minister is draped in our flag. So there was, of course, kind of hidden or not so hidden criticism of Israel's position there. So what are then the reasons for Israel's mild reaction towards Russia? And I guess most of this is well known already, but I'll just mention some of them. And the first and the foremost is Israel's security situation on its northern border, Syria. Iran has been trying for years and is still trying to get a stronger foothold in Syria to create a front against Israel in Syria, also with the help of Hezbollah and other terror organizations. And Israel has repeatedly and is repeatedly targeting these bases, Iranian bases, and weapon exports and so on. So there's a struggle going on in Syria between Israel and Iran. But Russia also has a huge military presence in this country, in Syria, and huge interest. And they are on good terms with Assad, the president of Syria. So Russia has huge influence on what could happen in that state. If Russia decides that they're not going to allow the Israeli attacks anymore, they could really create a lot of trouble for Israeli attacks against Iran in Syria. It's called, they have this anti-aircraft systems, anti-missile systems. It's S-300, S-400, and S-500. For now, I think S-300 is already placed in Syria, but it has not been used. Pretty advanced, but S-500 is the most advanced weapon defense system in the world when it comes to air defense. So it takes down both missiles and airplanes and whatever threat comes through the skies, so to say. It has shot down missiles 500 kilometers away, so it's hugely effective. And if Russia decides to place this in Syria and prevent Israeli attacks, it would create a lot of problems for Israel. So that is, of course, the big fear in Israel, the situation on the northern border. Then there is also the question of the Jewish population in Ukraine and in Russia. In Ukraine, there are some 300,000 to 400,000 Jews. They are Ukrainian citizens, but they are Jewish. And in Russia, of course, there are many more. In addition, in both countries, there are tens of thousands of Israelis. On a normal day, there are tens of thousands of Israelis in Ukraine. Now most of them have left. And I'm talking about Ukrainian Israelis, people that came from Ukraine, made aliyah to Israel, got a citizenship, but for some reason returned, maybe family, maybe to move back, maybe to work. So on a normal day, there would be like 10,000 Israelis there. Now the number is much lower because they have left. But these factors, that there are so many Jews in both countries, and the fact that there's a tragic story of anti-Semitism in both countries, and that anti-Semitism has been increasing the last few years, as it has in the western part of Europe. So that is also a cause for concern in Jerusalem, that if Israel is taking a very clear position for one of the other states, and of course that would be for Ukraine, it could lead to attacks on Jews in the other country, in Russia. And of course, not doing so could also lead to attack on Jews, could be seen as not loyal. But so Israel is trying, as the Jews did throughout history, to be kind of invisible in this case. Anyway, this is a consideration. It's not the main consideration, but it's a consideration as well. Then we have the Ukrainian story tells Israelis today. Tells the Israeli government today. Because what happens in Ukraine now is that Ukraine is left alone. Nobody is coming to help them, at least not sending proper help, soldiers and stuff. Even ammunition and weapons, and it's coming in very late. But Ukraine is on their own. There are no NATO troops coming. There are no other troops coming. And for Israel, that has been a lesson they have learned a long time ago. They are not demanding other soldiers to come and fight for them, but they are in need of support for ammunition, weapons and stuff from abroad. And they realize that in the end, they can only rely on themselves. So that is also a lesson they are learning from what is happening in Ukraine right now. And a last reason that I also hinted at already is that Israel sees itself as a kind of mediator. One of the few nations in the world that is able to speak to both sides and can potentially become a peacemaker in this conflict. So here are the reasons that I've picked up, at least, for why Israel is being moderate in their criticism of Russia. And then we might ask, so are they... are these reasons satisfactory? The Israelis on the streets, they are saying no. The media is saying no. But the politicians keep towing this line. And personally, I would like to see Israel take a clearer stand here for Ukraine. But this is their decision for now, and this is where they're going. One can understand... some of the arguments, especially the argument on security, which is the main one. Anyway, if we go on, speak about other consequences of this conflict, then we come to the Aliyah from Ukraine, because, as we said, hundreds of thousands of Jews are in that country, and they are eligible to make Aliyah, to immigrate to Israel. And some of them have started doing so. Many of their families have already done so. And now Israel is preparing for a huge aliyah from Ukraine. So I'll get back to that in a minute. Just say also that Israel has sent a lot of humanitarian aid to Ukraine. They sent three planes packed with equipment and food and stuff. And they're also sending medical teams. They're now preparing to send a field hospital, fully equipped for operations and surgical operations and so on, birth. So it will be a fully equipped field hospital. And they're sending people to the borders of Ukraine, and some are even going into Ukraine, into the war zone itself. Also, Israeli organizations, voluntary organizations, are operating inside, especially in the Jewish communities, but they're helping everyone that they can. So in that sense, there are a lot of Israelis that are doing something for Ukraine, not on in an official capacity always, but definitely a lot of activity on that side. Well, Israel is always sending help, humanitarian help, to disaster areas around the world. They are always almost best on that. And also in Israel, they are gathering food and preparing to receive immigrants. So according to Ayelet Shaked, the Israeli interior minister, she talks about tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of immigrants that will come from Ukraine as a result of this conflict. Now, other ministers are talking about 3,000 and 4,000. So here the estimations, they vary tremendously. But all of that is, of course, dependent on how long this conflict will be dragged out. So anyway, Israel is being prepared now and is preparing itself to receive tens of thousands of refugees. And in that connection, they have already started building communities in the Negev. This was already planned, but now it's being sped up. So 7 to 12 new communities will be built in the Negev in the coming months. They are then hoping to settle Ukrainian refugees, immigrants there. And That is, of course, also a policy that Israel needs to implement to develop the Negev. We talked about this previously. The center of Israel is completely overpopulated. There's no space any longer. So they need to develop the Negev. And also because the struggle against the Bedouin for land in the Negev is ongoing. And this can help also in that matter. So anyway, this is also something that is a result now that is sped up the whole process because of the war. Another factor I just want to mention is that, of course, Israel has almost 20% of its population is Russian speaking, meaning either they themselves or their parents came from Russia. In the 1990s, there was this huge aliyah of 1 million, more than 1 million Russian-speaking Jews from the former Soviet Union coming to Israel. And even if they came from Ukraine, then they would be also Russian speakers in addition to Ukrainian. So 20% are like Russian speakers. And many of them know each other. They know where they come from, which country, and so on. So there are stories about Russian Jews, Ukrainian Jews meeting on the streets in Jerusalem and all over the land, meeting in the shops and in the post offices, coffee shops, and they just look at each other. They know you come from Ukraine, I come from Russia, and they just embrace each other and cry. So there's also that factor to the entire thing, a unifying factor between the Jews of these countries in Israel, hopefully setting a precedent for what will come. Then we're going to continue talking about this conflict, but from another perspective, from a Christian perspective. And kind of looking at the other side of the coin. And before I do that, so let me just say, there should be no doubt that in my view, justice is on one side in this conflict, the Ukrainians. There is one aggressor, there is one invader, and there is one side that is doing, that has been done unjustice to. So Ukraine is on the moral high ground here. But having said that, I will also say something that it may be unpopular already, and it will be more and more difficult to say this as the destruction and the war is continuing and the innocent civilians that are killed, the number is increasing. So, but I think it needs to be said anyway. Because what we are seeing now is a united West denouncing Russia and the Russian aggression, and rightly so. But this is not a war against Russia or against Russians. The war is against an evil regime, and it's this regime is led by, in practical terms, a dictator, Vladimir Putin. Now, you can discuss the definition of dictator here because there are elections and so on in Russia. But he has been sitting in power for 20 years and all of his opponents are either imprisoned or dead. So there is something here that is, this is not a functioning democracy. And here it is his decision, his closest advisors, their decision to make this war. And the people, as I understand it, are not with him. I'll get back to that. Now, NATO and the West, they stand united, place a lot of sanctions on Russian economy and help Ukraine in every possible way. And that's as it should be. We should really try to limit his freedom of movement. It could put sanctions on the Russian economy and so on. But do we really need to boycott Russian violinists or Russian tennis players? Do we need to take away the books of Russian authors from our bookstores? Do we need to deny Russian kids the possibility to join our summer tournaments in football? And is it right by companies like IKEA and Apple to say that we will no longer do businesses in Russia. I mean, are these the ways that we need to react, and is this the way right way to do it? I can understand sanctions that go against Russia as a nation when Russia is represented, like as a national team, for instance. I can understand that that would be a problem. Also is in the Eurovision Song Contest, when Russia is represented as a nation, as a land, country, that would be a problem. But when you come as an individual, when you come as a team, football team, local football team, or tennis player, do we really need to boycott? Because what's the result of that kind of behavior? Well, in principle, we are telling the Russian people that their president is right, that Putin is right. Because what is Putin saying? Well, he says the West is filled with Russophobia. There's a fear of Russia in the West, and that's what we need to deal with. Now, by doing this, we are telling the Russians he's right. What we are doing is that we are isolating Russians, the people, from the West. And by that, we are preventing encounters between Russians and people in the Europeans. Now, Russia is also Europe, but you understand, in the West. We are preventing these encounters from taking place, and it's those encounters that tear down the walls of prejudice. It's those encounters that tear down stereotypes. But instead, we are building up under negative stereotypes from our side and from their side by refusing to meet with them, to have any contact with them. In this way, we are perpetuating the conflict and putting it into a mold of steel. So I'm fortunate to have friends in both Russia and Ukraine. And I've been been in touch with both this last week. Now, the Ukrainian view is heard, and we're hearing it all the time, so I don't need to repeat what they're saying. They are in a terrible situation. Their suffering is tremendous, and as we know, 1 million are now refugees outside of their country or on their way to the borders. But the Russian story is not heard that much. And the way I understand it is that the huge majority of the Russians are against this war. I mean, they are normal people. They are wonderful people. And they know that they are brothers and sisters with the Ukrainians. They are so close to each other. It's my understanding, and of course I don't have the statistics on this, but the huge majority of them are against the war and are against Putin. And they're talking about him in no less critical tone than we are doing here. You see this also by the huge demonstrations that have taken place in many cities around Russia, where hundreds and sometimes thousands are out in the streets demonstrating against the war. And by that, they are risking prison from 3 to 15 years. 3 years of just participating and 15 years if you are the organizer of these kind of events. So this is a huge price to pay in this state. But still, they go out in the streets. Now, I see this as part of a bigger phenomenon, this desire and to boycott everything Russian, because the Western world has the last few years gone through a phase and a development that is very negative. We are on a continuous search to find fault with others. When finding these faults, it's not only enough that we condemn them, but we need to uproot this phenomenon. We have become so radical in our struggle for moral purity, what we consider and define as moral purity, that we almost, or not almost, we become hateful in our efforts to uproot these phenomenons. Now, whether we call this woke culture, whether we call this cancel culture, or whether we call it patriotism from the other side of this ideological spectrum, it doesn't really matter. But there is a tendency and a need, it seems, to to deny and to condemn others that are thinking differently than we are. By this, we have created a hate culture. And in hating, we believe ourselves to be moral. I mean, there are even huge demonstrations in the streets where they destroy property and they even attack people, and they believe they are doing this. It's well and good because they're doing it for a good cause. This is a perverted view of justice. And as Christians, we cannot participate in this. First of all, when we do this, when we point finger at others, we always need to know that there are three fingers pointing back at us. And that's something we have totally forgotten. We are so busy criticizing others that we are very lax with ourselves. But for Christians, we cannot and must not be drawn into this flood wave of hatred. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, "Blessed are the peacemakers." He didn't say, "Blessed are the ideologically pure." Blessed are the peacemakers. It is true. He also said that he is the truth, and the truth must and will prevail. But that truth must come with grace. He said, "I have come with grace and with truth." Because truth without grace can be brutal. It can be destructive. Then you're into this ideological purity that you yourself define. And as we see, it leads to a hateful attitude towards others where mercy is gone. So while standing solidly on the side of justice in this conflict and supporting Ukraine, that's something we should do. Let us not forget at the same time that we are Christians. And by that, I mean the way it was used in the beginning, Christ-like. Let us remember that. This is who we are. We should be Christ-like. So let us support and pray for those who work against the evil Russian regime inside Russia. But let us also here welcome Russians and, of course, Ukrainians in our midst. And if we don't have them in our midst, then let us welcome them in our attitudes. We can afford to be generous because we have ourselves been shown tremendous generosity. That takes us to the next topic, and that is Vienna and Iran. The deal with Iran that is being shaped in Vienna in these days. The negotiations regarding Iran's nuclear program is now in its last phase. It's the eighth round, supposed to be the last. Some sources say that still huge differences remain between the sides, but other sources say that the U.S. is really capitulating to Iran. Because the U.S. is so desperate after a deal, and I'm talking about the Biden administration. Now, the war in Ukraine has hardened Iran's positions, according to reports coming out. The U.S. is now busy with what is going on in Europe and has less time for what goes on with Iran. That's the way. And also, there's less media attention on it, so they can afford to be more lax, it seems. I will get back to the reasons why I say this. Now, Iran, they are demanding guarantees from the U.S. that the U.S. will not leave the deal as Trump did. But at the same time, they refuse to answer, for instance, where some nuclear material that was found by the inspectors inside Iran, where that came from, what it was for. They refused to answer such questions, and during the years that the agreement was in effect, they denied inspectors freedom of access. So they broke the deal time after another, and now also they refuse to give answers for this nuclear material. But instead, they are demanding that the U.S. give them concessions for breaking the agreement. So it's really an upside-down world here that the U.S. has allowed themselves to go into. According to A former official at the U.S. State Department, Gabriel Narona, was on the working with Iran, Iranian issues there. He said, according to the contacts that he has, that the negotiations in Vienna are dictated by Russia through their representative here in Vienna, Mikhail Ulyanov. But what is happening is a total disaster, according to Narona. So three of the U.S. negotiators have left the delegation because of the massive U.S. concessions. They don't want to have any part of it. And again, I'm quoting Narona here, or like referring to him. He says that the deal being negotiated is dangerous to U.S. security. It is illegal because some of the sanctions that now the U.S. promised to lift, these are sanctions that they cannot lift unless there is a legal process needed in the U.S. first. So it's illegal, illegitimate. He also says that the U.S. intends to lift a lot of sanctions connected to terror activity, including in terror activity by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Command. And that is the organization that is close to the regime, to the Mullah regime, that is responsible for planning and or implementing terror attacks in 35 different countries. So among other things, the U.S. is planning to lift sanctions on terror attacks that took place long before this nuclear deal. Has nothing to do with a nuclear deal. For instance, the attack in Buenos Aires, that the Jewish center in Buenos Aires, 1980s, that killed 85 people. And also Iranian attack, Hezbollah on U.S. Marines in Beirut, and a lot of other terror attacks and terror activity. People that have been involved in this, they're going to lift sanctions. They're also going to lift sanctions on Iranian trade and selling of oil. So economically, if this goes through, Iran will thrive. They will have so many billions of dollars being flooded into their economy that will again make them able to fund terror all over the region in the Middle East and also all over the world. It's really crazy if this is true, what this Narona says. Now, in return, what is the U.S. getting? Almost nothing, because the Iranian nuclear program has come so far, it's almost too late to get anything substantial in return. And it's definitely not going to be near anything the former deal, which also was bad. Maybe they will get a few British or American prisoners in Iranian jails released. So it's a really bad deal that is seems to be going to be signed in Vienna the coming days. What will happen as a result of that deal is that Iran will be just a few weeks within a few years they will be just a few weeks from going nuclear. I mean, it will be a decision that they will have to make to take the final step, and that will only take them a few weeks, and they will be a nuclear nation. So Melanie Phillips, which she is a commentator in Great Britain, she says the following: if Narona, what is the former U.S. Secretary of State official, if he's correct, then under cover of the Ukraine crisis, an act of supreme treachery is being perpetrated by the Biden administration against America and the West, in empowering the Iranian regime. An enemy of civilization that has been at war against America, Israel, and the West since it came to power in 1979. So that's how strong words she uses. She talks this a supreme act of treachery being perpetrated against the West. So, it's something that is happening in the behind closed doors and in the shadow of what is going on in Ukraine. And it seems like the Biden administration has decided that no concession is too big. We want this deal for whatever price it will cost. just briefly about Israeli politics. The politic, what you say, the life in Israel when it comes to politics, the life in the Knesset is pretty chaotic these last few weeks. And of course, we have talked about this many times, that it is a problematic coalition. Now, what has happened, especially this last week, was that there was almost fist fights going on, not inside the plenum, but in the corridors around, between opposition and coalition politicians, and also internally in the governing coalition. So what has happened is that the governing coalition, there's almost constantly one or two parties that is now voting against its own coalition. They're taking greater liberty to do this. And that, of course, leads to the opposition winning certain votes. Now, and also that the coalition has to withdraw its own bills because they see they don't have a majority. So it's quite chaotic what is going on. Now, this week, the opposition saw a chance to topple the government. So they declared a certain vote, vote of no confidence. But the coalition managed to scramble all its representatives to vote against this. So they managed. But you see, this is really tearing this this coalition apart. And as we said so many times, how long can this go on? It's a really big question mark. But still, for now, the anti-Netanyahu attitude, it is a glue that still keeps this coalition together. And now, within a week, there will be a break. The parliament will not be in session. So that will be a good period for the coalition to try to recover, see if they can create some unity and go into the summer session after that, or spring session after that, on a new level, so to say. Anyway, pretty chaotic what goes on in Israeli politics these days. Archaeology, and it's really more about inspecting and trying to preserve archaeology than real finding. Because Israel has tons of archaeological sites. So almost every hill is an archaeological site. And this, of course, leads to a lot of treasure hunters trying to find something for themselves, which, of course, is illegal. So Israel has inspectors that travels around the country and tries to grab these looters. Now, there was a story in an article here about one of them, one of these inspectors, where he spoke about how he was performing his work, and it was really not a glorious job sometimes, lying out in the bushes, in the darkness, in the rain, and watching out for these looters. They are also armed, these inspectors, because some of these looters can be dangerous. But anyway, every day, somebody is looting an archaeological site in Israel. And these looters, according to the inspector that was interviewed, they may be of three types. They may be experts, meaning they have archaeological training. They know what to look for. They know how to excavate, and they do it carefully. They don't destroy a lot because they know exactly how to do things. So they don't destroy a lot, but they find the valuables. They find the most important things. Then you have the treasure hunters that are more like hobby amateurs. They don't know how to do things. Sometimes they would come with tractors and just smash stuff, destroy, make huge destructions. And sometimes they find something of value, and sometimes they miss it. They go just past it because they really don't know what to look for. And then you have the third category, which is families. A father and his children, grandfather and his grandchildren. They're just out for fun and doing stuff and not so very organized. But everything is, of course, looting if they bring with them archaeological artifacts. So there is a number of people working to prevent this inside Israel, and they have a huge job, especially after a rainy season when things are uncovered, the soil is moving and so on. So that's when many things come up in the open. This phenomenon has doubled has increased tremendously under the corona crisis when people have been staying at home. They didn't have much to do, so they went out and started looking for treasures. These inspectors then are not only looking for those that dig, but they're also going after the dealers and they're going after the buyers. So this is a huge thing in Israel, and we really hope and pray that they will be successful, because it's of course like this, that once something is taken out of its context, it loses a lot of value. It doesn't yield as much information as it could give if experts really found it in place. So a problem for Israel, and we hope they will be successful, these inspectors. And by the way, I didn't mention all the things that go on in Judea and Samaria, where Israel has less resources to look after, where Palestinian Arabs are looting systematically sites. We have talked about this previously. Now we come to Parashat HaShavua, the weekly Torah portion, which is Pekudei, and it's from Exodus 38:21 to 40:38. That's the last chapters of Exodus. Summary. A list of the materials used to build the tabernacle is given, and the values of the silver and gold and so on that has been used. And then there's the description on how the ephod, again, how the ephod was made. We have had this before. It's a repetition, so to say. And also how the breastplate with its 12 stones was made, other priestly garments, the robe, the tunic, turban. Then there's the description of how all was completed and how it worked. Then the tabernacle is erected and put in order. The cloud of the presence of God then covers the tabernacle. And when the cloud lifts, the people travel onwards. And when it sets down again, then the people stop and camp. So that's the story of this week's portion. So one commentator speaks about what we can call open books. And it's what Moses is doing here in the beginning when he lists how much silver was used and how much gold was used. Because what he does is really he's giving an account of, hey, you gave offering so we could build the tabernacle. Here is what we have been using your offering for. He's giving an account. How much gold, silver, precious stones, how much fabric and so on that were used. So did the people demand that he should give a reckoning? Probably not. Doesn't say, at least. Did he have to do it? Also probably not. He was quite a sovereign leader at the time. But this was a holy work, and Moses therefore wanted everything to be open, out in the open. That's the impression you can get. Or whether God prompted him to put everything out in the open. But the principle is, it gives a good lesson. And the lesson is that also, or especially, when a work that is given to serve God's purposes in such a concrete way is going to be built, it should be open to scrutiny. So that's a lesson for us today. It should always be out in the open, the things we do, but all the more so when it is a holy work. So, of course, Christian work, Christian organization, church, whatever, should be very open. And because this is holy, it cannot afford that it will be contaminated by something unholy. Another commentator speaks about stopping up and considering. He points to the fact that the first verse and the last verse of the Exodus, the book, and the first verse starts like this. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came out, who came to Egypt with Jacob. Each man and his household came. So that's the first verse. Family extended family coming out of Canaan into Egypt, 70 people. And the last verse is that, for the cloud of the Lord was upon the tabernacle by day and the fire at night, before the eyes of the entire house of Israel in all their journeys. So what this commentator is saying is that if you look at the development that has taken place here, from the very beginning when you have an extended family coming down to Egypt, not so much aim, not so much vision around them, and then in the end you have a people living under God's law. They have received the law at Mount Sinai, and they have the presence of God himself in the midst of them. And now they are an entire nation. So what has happened here is huge. They had their Exodus, they saw the miracles of God, and they have been shaped and formed into a nation under God. So from being just an extended family without much purpose, I mean, at least apparently, there was, of course, the promises that had already been spoken on this family. But anyway, it is a huge difference, and sometimes it would be good just to, when you reach a certain stage, look back and just see what have we gone through? Where are we today? Where were we 10 years ago, 15 years ago? And just give thanks to God, praise God, because there is really progress when you look upon it in that over time. And in the society that we live in today, this is not really encouraged, and it doesn't give a lot of options and opportunities to do this. So you need to take that opportunity yourself. You need to decide, I want to step up, consider the goodness of God on my life. So good commentary there on this last portion of Exodus. So that takes us to the end and to the priestly blessing that we want to pronounce upon Israel. Yevarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha. Ya'er Adonai panav elecha v'yechoneka. Yesa Adonai panav elecha v'yasem lecha shalom. Amen. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing this podcast with others. And thank you for praying for all the things that we speak about. And also, of course, you are free to support the work. You find us our website, israelnext.com. You can press give there. So thank you so much. And until next time, say something good about Israel.